WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Bryce Claypool with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, August 29th. On Tuesday, Sarasota County Commissioners unanimously approved a 6.4% increase in water rates. Through their water bills, Sarasota County residents will pay for a new reservoir and water treatment facility the Peace River Authority is building in DeSoto County in response to rapid population growth. Sarasota County's share of the project is estimated at $337 million, and that's expected to result in a $30 million increase to annual debt service beginning in 2030. Manatee County Commissioners will vote Tuesday on whether to join a lawsuit against a new Florida law. After several new commissioners took office last year, Manatee County has been promising to strengthen protections for wetlands and rural areas. But state agencies and local developers say SB 180, a law passed by the Florida legislature this year, ties the county's hands. It includes a provision barring local governments from enacting land use policies deemed more burdensome. Last week, commissioners backed off implementing the proposed policies over fears that Governor DeSantis might suspend them from office, but they promised they weren't backing down. The meeting on whether to join the lawsuit, brought by municipalities around the state, will be held at 9 a.m. Tuesday at the County Administration Building in Bradenton. Residents are raising alarm over fish kills caused by toxic algae flaring up in Manatee County. In Palmasola Bay, a dinoflagellate algae bloom is turning the water reddish-brown and causing fish kills. Suncoast Waterkeeper Executive Director Abby Turner told The Observer, "The blooms can put excess nutrients into waterways, increasing the risk of red tide outbreaks. The bloom may be dissipating," she said, "but we can only wait and see." DOGE is squeezing Orange County now. Florida's new cost-cutting task force has generated lots of controversy in recent weeks. Critics contend the state government is using the agency to erode home rule and punish local governments that aren't ideologically aligned with the state. One of DOGE's main targets is Orange County, home of Orlando, where a conflict is now escalating. Florida's chief financial officer, Blaise Ingaglia, announced Wednesday that he'll be issuing subpoenas for 16 Orange County employees. He's alleging the employees hid information about diversity, equity, and inclusion grants from DOGE. This has been Bryce Claypool with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, August 29th.
The program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who with the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. I have to wonder what people who believe the reasons given during the campaign for what was needed to be corrected in government are thinking now. Whatever happened to eliminating fraud, waste, and abuse? And how about only deporting criminals who are in the country legally? These days, those motivations don't even get lip service. How could they complain about fraud, waste, and abuse when budget cuts to critical services are being used to increase the already bloated Defense Department budget to over $1 trillion and provide tax relief to the billionaires? And it is painfully clear the deportation goals of a million or so undocumented persons cannot be met by only targeting criminals. There just aren't enough of them. Maybe by the end of the year, even ardent MAGA supporters will have to admit they were lied to about those issues and others when the nonsensical trade war jacks up prices, so Christmas will not be very merry for children wanting any toys made in China. Maybe some of those former supporters will be joining Julie Forrester, president of the Democratic Women's Club of Sarasota, and my guest today at the Workers Over Billionaires rally set for Monday, who will fill us in on some of the details about that event. But first, hear this chilling story about how we may be seeing National Guard troops in other major American cities. President Donald Trump signed an executive order this week directing state National Guard units to be ready to assist local, state, and federal law enforcement, a potential step towards a dramatic expansion of Trump's use of military personnel for domestic policing. The order calls for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to ensure troops in the National Guard of every state are resourced, trained, organized, and available to assist federal, state, and local law enforcement in quelling civil disturbances and ensuring the public safety, and directs the Secretary to establish a standing National Guard quick reaction force for nationwide deployment. Hegseth will also work with adjutant generals and decide a number of each state's guard to be reasonably available for rapid mobilization for such purposes, the order says. State National Guard units are generally controlled by the state's governor, except in emergencies and comments in the Oval Office. Trump said the guard deployment could rapidly solve crime in some major cities, but left doubt about his desire to overrule governors who do not want Guard troops in their cities. Trump mobilized the District of Columbia National Guard, which he is able to do because the district is not a state, to assist local law enforcement this month. Guard troops from West Virginia, Louisiana, Ohio, Mississippi, Tennessee, and South Carolina also have sent troops to the nation's capital. Free DC, a group that advocates for district self-governance, issued a lengthy statement calling the move dictatorial. Trump is laying the groundwork to quell all public dissent to his agenda. If he is successful, it would spell the end of American democracy, the group said. We refuse to allow that to happen. Following the deployment to Washington, D.C., Trump said Chicago should be next. Democratic governors such as Illinois' J.B. Pritzker should request National Guard assistance, Trump said, but they would not, Trump said he may not send troops. Asked if he would send troops into cities over governor's objections, Trump complained that governors could be ungrateful for federal deployment. We may wait, he continued. We may not. We may just go ahead and do it, which is probably what we should do. The problem is that it's not nice when you go in and you do it, and somebody else is standing there saying, as we have great results, say, well, we don't want the military. Pritzker slammed Trump in social media and said that he would not accept Trump sending troops to his state's largest city. I've said it once, I'll say it again and again. We don't have kings or wannabe dictators in America, and I don't intend to bend the knee to this one, he posted with a link to Trump's comments. The 1878 Posse Comitatus Act generally prohibits federal military forces from engaging in domestic law enforcement. Trump dismissed criticism that deploying the military for law enforcement purposes is anti-democratic, saying that most people agree with extreme measures to crack down on urban crime. They say, we don't need him. Freedom, freedom. He's a dictator, Trump said of his critics. A lot of people are saying, maybe we like a dictator. I don't like a dictator. I'm not a dictator. I'm a man with great common sense and a smart person. And when I see what's happening in our cities, and then you send in troops, instead of being praised, they're saying, you're trying to take over the republic. These people are sick. Trump earlier this summer called up the California National Guard to quell protests over immigration enforcement in Los Angeles, setting the stage for his actions in the district. California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, has challenged the president's authority in a case that is still in court. Trump over the weekend also fought with Maryland Governor Wes Moore, also a Democrat, on social media and threatened to send in troops to Baltimore. Let's see if those cuts to FEMA were really worth the savings after this year's hurricane season. With the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina this week, current and former board employees of the Federal Emergency Management Agency are warning that budget cuts to the agency could soon become a major problem with several months left in the Atlantic hurricane season. One of the biggest things that I'll be watching for is whether or not FEMA is going to be able to pre-position resources ahead of storm's impact like they have in the past, said Deanne Criswell, who served as FEMA administrator during the Biden administration, in a Zoom call this week. What we've heard is that they want to turn the responsibility for managing disasters to the state and locals, but they already had the responsibility. FEMA can only come in and support if a state asks them to, but they have to have the ability to be proactive and get resources ready and anticipate what they think a state may ask for. Earlier on Monday, more than 180 current and former FEMA employees issued a letter to Congress warning that the Trump administration has set back much of the progress in disaster response and recovery since Katrina smashed New Orleans in 2005. The group listed six statements of opposition to what is going on at FEMA, such as the requirement by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem that she personally must review and approve all contracts, grants, and mission assignments over $100,000. That means every single decision that goes into a response and recovery would require additional approval, and that's what we saw as a failing during Hurricane Katrina, and I would fear that that's really going to have an impact on the ability for some of these really large-scale events to slow down FEMA's ability to support the people who have been impacted, said Criswell. In their letter, the group proposed that the failure to appoint a qualified FEMA administrator as required by law. Cameron Brown, former acting head of FEMA, was fired in May after he told lawmakers the day before that he didn't know that it was in the public's interest to dismantle the federal agency. He was replaced by David Richardson, who has no experience managing natural disasters. Criswell noted that this was also the case when Katrina hit in 2005, when Michael D. Brown served as FEMA director under President George W. Bush, had been a lawyer active in GOP politics and in Oklahoma, who had supervised police and fire departments as an assistant manager in an Oklahoma City suburb before being appointed to lead FEMA in 2003. And she said she's concerned that there have been several regional administrators who have stepped down in recent months. If you're a good leader and you're going to rely on the knowledge and skills and abilities of your staff, yet we've seen much of the leadership across FEMA also leave, she said. The Zoom call was organized by the group Sabotaging Our Safety, and that included Jacksonville Democrat Rep. Angie Nixon and two other Democrats running for office this year, former Miami-Dade County Senator Jorge Javier Rodriguez, who is running for Attorney General, and Colonel Darren McAuley, running for Congress in Florida's 15th District. We need to be very clear that FEMA cuts will have direct impact on the health and well-being and medical care of our neighbors and communities, McAuley said. FEMA helps us prepare for a storm, but it also helps us to mitigate the response after the storm. President Donald Trump said in June that he intends to phase FEMA out after this year's hurricane season. In April, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said that the state could handle emergencies without federal funds, but said that he didn't believe the president would do so without the federal government giving grants to the state. FEMA approved more than $1 billion in individual assistance last year to Floridians following destruction from Hurricanes Milton, Helene, and Debbie. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. More wasted drugs and potential resurgence of disease is another consequence of DOGE cuts. Millions of drugs used to treat debilitating and disfiguring tropical diseases risk going to waste after U.S. aid cuts stalled treatment campaigns, leaving vital medications to expire in warehouses. Experts fear the funding crisis could sabotage hard-won progress in the global fight against conditions such as river blindness and intestinal worms. This has been a major blow, said Ablas Gabriela, a disease expert at the World Health Organization. It could lead to diseases resurging and derail progress in countries close to eliminating them. Since 2006, the United States has invested more than $1.4 billion in tackling what are known as neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, helping 14 countries end at least one disease. But the program was axed this year after President Donald Trump slashed foreign aid. In Africa alone, 1.6 million medicines, mostly tablets, have already expired. 8 million more are set to by year end, and another 90 million by May 2026, according to WHO figures provided to the Thomson Reuters Foundation. The WHO is working with African countries and health partners to save drugs close to expiring, piggybacking deliveries onto other community health services such as vaccination drives. There are 21 NTDs, which affect more than a billion people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. They afflict the poorest communities, and the sickest and disabilities they cause only deepen that poverty by leaving people unable to work. Experts estimate the global toll in terms of lost wages and health expenses amounts to at least $33 billion annually. Investing in NTDs is not just treating diseases. It also helps free communities from poverty, Gabriella said. USAID, now the defunct U.S. aid organization, targeted five of the most common diseases: schizosomastis, river blindness, elephantitis, trachoma, and intestinal worms. Before its termination, USAID worked with 26 countries, mostly in Africa, supporting the delivery of billions of drugs provided for free by major pharmaceutical companies. Every dollar invested by the United States leveraged $26 in donated medicines, according to a USAID fact sheet. Most are used in mass drug administrations, which treat everyone in a given area, infected or not. The WHO said the U.S. cuts have delayed 47 treatment campaigns. The crisis has also cost jobs. In Sierra Leone alone, 30,000 community drug distributors have lost work. In January, Niger became the first country in Africa to be declared free of river blindness, a disease causing itching, disfiguring skin conditions, and vision loss. Other successes this year included the elimination of sleeping sickness in Kenya and Guinea, and trachoma in Senegal, Burundi, Mauritania, and Papua New Guinea. But Trump is not the only donor to turn away. Britain ended its NTD program in 2021, while recent reductions in global aid have further squeezed funding. Preventing diseases requires investment in water and sanitation, another sector hit hard by aid cuts, and robust monitoring to stop any resurgence. Solomon Zuidu, CEO of the END Fund, a philanthropic organization focused on NTDs, warned the cuts could have consequences down the line if surveillance is neglected. Ridding Niger of river blindness has been hailed as a beacon of hope, but the black fly that spreads it can travel 250 miles a day. Diseases don't understand borders, Zuidu said. The cuts could threaten the long-term success of the wins that we've had if we take our eye off the ball. Remember when COVID vaccines were universally regarded as lifesavers? Not so much anymore. The Trump administration will move to pull the COVID vaccine off the U.S. market within months, one of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s closest associates has told the Daily Beast. Dr. Asimi Malhotra, a British cardiologist who has repeatedly claimed, in the face of scientific consensus, that vaccines are more dangerous than the virus, told the Daily Beast that Kennedy's stance is shared by influential members of President Donald Trump's family. Like Kennedy himself, no Trumps hold any scientific qualifications. Malhotra is a leading advisor to the controversial lobby group Make America Healthy Again Action, which has seen as an external arm of Kennedy's agenda as Health and Human Services Secretary. He told the Beast that many of those closest to RFK Jr. have told him that they cannot understand why the vaccine continues to be prescribed, and that a decision to remove the vaccine from the U.S. market pending further research will come within months, even if it's likely to cause fear of chaos and would bring with it major legal ramifications. It could happen in a number of stages, including learning more about the data, said Malhotra, who said the ongoing review in so-called vaccine injuries by the Advisory Committee and Committee on Immunization Practices. But given the increased talk of vaccine injuries in the past few weeks among the administration, it could also come with one clean decision. Malhotra said skepticism among Kennedy's circle of the COVID-19 jab is driven by a 2022 paper by a group of physicians and university professors and researchers, which appeared in the journal Vaccine. The peer-reviewed paper examined the secondary analysis of serious adverse events reported in clinical trials of Pfizer and Moderna mRNA COVID-19 vaccines in adults, and said that those given the mRNA vaccines had a 16% higher risk of excess serious adverse events than those in the placebo group. However, the study has been dismissed by large parts of the medical community, who say it underestimates the benefits of COVID-19 vaccines and overstates risks due to methodological flaws based on data selection and ignoring broader public health impacts. Malhotra was not among the authors of the study, but said that he presented its findings during the MAHA Action Team video meeting on July 9th, which was attended by senior aides to Kennedy. He claimed it caused a holy SHIT moment among many of those present. Malhotra is known to have the ear of RFK, having first drawn his attention in September of 2022 when he published a paper in the Journal of Insulin Resistance on what he described as misinformation about COVID mRNA vaccine, which led to a television interview. After he walked out of the studio, Malhotra said the first person to call was RFK Jr. He said, "I want to thank you for your courage," Malhotra said. The pair have since become close. Malhotra is now expected to meet Trump himself in September to push his anti-COVID-19 mRNA vax views during a trip to meet Kennedy and other HHS aides. The prediction of a drastic move against COVID vaccine comes after Kennedy canceled $500 million in funding for the development of mRNA vaccines. Such vaccines use a copy of a molecule called messenger RNA, mRNA, to provoke an immune response against certain diseases. They have received much attention since the COVID-19 pandemic, where they served as the basis of most of the most widely used SARS-CoV-2 vaccines. Vaccine skepticism took a sinister turn earlier this month when an anti-vaxxer opened fire on the Centers of Disease Control, killing a police officer. Investigators believe the man targeted the CDC over his hatred of COVID-19 vaccine, apparently convinced he was sick or would become sick because of it. This week, more than 750 current and former staff members from the CDC, HHS, and National Institutes of Health accused Kennedy of spreading dangerous misinformation that fueled mistrust and contributed to the CDC HQ shooting, demanding by September 2nd that he stop, affirm CDC scientific integrity, and guarantee workforce safety. They also argue that Kennedy has jeopardized Americans' health and undermined the nation's readiness for public health crises. In a letter to Congress, Ann Kennedy, which was posted on the Save HHS site, they wrote, "Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is complicit in dismantling America's public health infrastructure and endangering the nation's health by repeatedly spreading inaccurate health information." Being president is apparently not enough for he who would be king. President Trump's many roles, formal and self-designated, add a new one to the list. Chairman of all boards, Axios Managing Editor for Business Ben Berkowitz writes, "The president has assumed the quasi-authority to orchestrate how the private sector operates, both broadly and down to the management and ownership of individual companies. No one's stopping him, so he continues to confidently plow ahead." Those with insight into his strategy argue that it's anything but arbitrary. There's a mold-breaking calculus to the plan, they say, centered on national security and American competitiveness. The director of the National Security Council, Kevin Hassett, told CNBC's Squawk Box yesterday that the government's new stake in Intel was a down payment on the creation of a sovereign wealth fund, adding it was absolutely right that Trump should seek such investments. In other words, if you're a private company, you may soon be invited to sell a chunk of your business to the government, even at the cost of diluting existing shareholders. There are plenty of examples this year of Trump telling businesses how to do business. Chip companies that wanted to do business in China being ordered to hand over 15% of their revenue to get export licenses. Apple being squeezed for another $100 billion investment commitment to avoid huge tariffs for not making its phones in the U.S. U.S. Steel having to hand over a golden share to Trump's personal control to reverse the rejection of its sale to Nippon Steel. Law firms being ordered to hand over free services to the government to avoid being pursued over their past work. It's not just private industry. Sports and entertainment businesses are also being pushed around. Trump threatened to derail the Washington Commanders' new stadium deal unless the team changed its name back to the Redskins. He demanded that the Baseball Hall of Fame include Pete Rose and, more recently, Roger Clemens. ABC and NBC are being threatened with losing their various local broadcast licenses because Trump doesn't like their reporting on him. Do I need my passport when I drive in Florida now? The next time you're pulled over, you may be asked for your license, your registration, and your naturalization papers are other proof that you're from the United States. Florida's Attorney General is leading an opening for law enforcement to pull over vehicles with probable cause to check whether drivers are in fact American or not. During an interview this week on Newsmax, James Uthmeyer affirmed that he was absolutely encouraging police to pull over vehicles if there's probable cause to do so or if they do so naturally at a checkpoint as part of doing everything necessary to protect Floridians in the wake of the Harjinder Singh's alleged triple vehicle homicide on the Florida Turnpike. "It's uncertain whether there would be a suspicion for a crime beyond being in this country illegally to meet Uthmeyer's probable cause threshold, but he vigorously defends his vigilance. Even after the crash just two nights ago, we detained an illegal alien in Bay County in the Panhandle who had received one of these driver's licenses from New Jersey. We had a couple of other people pulled over at checkpoints in the last 24 hours, so it's clear that this is a broad problem, Uthmir said. Uthmir announced this week that the AG's office would work with Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services to ramp up inspections at state entry points for illegal aliens who may be operating large trucks using out-of-state driver's licenses. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Removal Operations Acting Executive Director Garrett Ripa said the checkpoints strengthened national security earlier this week. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Julie Forrester, president of the Democratic Women's Club of Sarasota.
I am Lularanian. I'm happy to welcome back Julie Forrester, president of the Democratic Women's Club of Sarasota, who are hosting another protest of the current administration called Workers Over Billionaires, set for Monday. That happens to be Labor Day. Hey, Julie, how you doing today?
Doing well, all things considered.
Yes, of course. You know, and thanks, of course, for coming on. From what I read, this event is going to build on the momentum of past nationwide coordinated protests, including the Hands Off, May Day, No Kings, Good Trouble. What is going to happen in Sarasota on Monday?
We are meeting at Bayfront Park at 5:30. We'll hear from a number of speakers that have been very involved in this work in the 50-51 movement, in workers' rights, in public education rights. And so we are going to unite for some speakers at J.D. Hamill Park at 5:30. And then after that, we are just going to wave our signs and show our solidarity and, have a visible display of opposition to the billionaire takeover of our government.
Yeah, do you have any idea who's going to be speaking?
I know we are still finalizing those details. I know that we have Sarah Parker and Saide Smith from Voices of Florida will be there, and I'm not sure about who else at this point.
Yeah, Sarah's also, one of the 50-51 organizers, as I'm sure you know. That sounds great. You know, I mean, from what I read, though, there are going to be, there's something going on during the day, too. I mean, I know that's the event, the one at Bayfront Park at 5:30 is the one that's been organized by your group. But, from what I understand, isn't there going to be something else?
I believe there are four different events happening in this area on Labor Day. I know that there is one in Venice. I believe that there is one or two in Manatee County as well, though I don't have all the details on them in front of me at this moment.
Yeah, let me actually pop it up. I thought there was going to be one that is connected to the May Day Strong Coalition. That involved unions.
Yes, this one will involve the unions. We're working on getting an SEIU representative to be speaking at it, but we haven't confirmed that yet.
Okay, yeah, that's what I wanted to know. Yeah, is this in connection? I mean, I know that there are going to be Workers Over Billionaires protests happening. And from what I read, well over 500 places. There's going to be, I guess, 765 is like the latest number that I saw. Is this, obviously in connection with that?
Yes, absolutely. This is the 50-51 day of action, the Workers Over Billionaires protest.
Yeah, I heard, too, that there was going to be, perhaps, one of these groups is going to be marching downtown.
We had discussed marching downtown, but we had decided against it because it's going to be in the evening time, like at 5:30 to 7:30, which is just a hotter time of the day. We had originally hoped to do it downtown during the day, but there is also a fentanyl awareness march happening at that time in the same location, and so we didn't want to be disrespectful. So we changed it to the evening, and because the evening is hotter, we decided that we were just going to protect people's health. You know, there's a lot of older people that show up at our protests that can't march because it's hot. And so we decided we were just going to wave signs, and that would be a really strong, strong sign of solidarity, and visibility would also be increased because we will all be, you know, at the Bayfront for that whole time when there'll be a lot of cars driving by, you know, coming on and off Lido and all of that as well. So,
yeah, you know, it's I'm just curious. I know the last time we spoke, which was I guess around the time of the No Kings, you had indicated the membership, at least in your group, was growing pretty good, growing pretty robustly.
Yes.
Is that kind of continuing for you?
Oh yeah, yeah. We're having new members sign up every day. We're having, you know, at least 100 people at all of our events, like all of our meetings. The biggest protest that we've had so far was the No Kings protest, and that was like around 9,000 people, which was an incredible turnout. And, you know, more and more people are showing up every day because this isn't about Democrats versus Republicans or left versus right. It's really about all of us uniting against the billionaire takeover of our democracy. Billionaires are turning government into their private plush fund, cutting healthcare, defunding schools, driving up costs for working families. And so what we're doing on Labor Day is showing that workers outnumber billionaires, and that when we stand together, we win. This really isn't about, this isn't about left versus right. This is about people power, solidarity, and building a movement that puts workers, families, and communities over billionaire greed.
Absolutely, yeah. And all these protests, and you know, I mean, my own observation. I mean, compared to the first time He Who Would Be King was elected, you know, there was that gigantic protest at the inauguration, you know, but then things kind of petered out. This time around, response, you know, rightly so, you know, is continuing to gain strength and grow, you know, now that we're what, 9 months in? Feels like nine years.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, because every time you turn around, you know, there's something crazy coming out of the White House, I don't mean that facetiously. You know, I mean actually crazy.
Yeah. And it's meant to overwhelm us and to make us feel like we don't have any power, and to, you know, have us fighting all these different, you know, all these different things, and to separate us so that we're all fighting in our own silos. And that's why these 50-51 protests have been, you know, really important and a really great uniting force, because no matter what issue he is attacking, like, we can all come together and we can all, you know, show our outrage and rally together in solidarity. And then it just sends a message to people that, you know, might be sitting at home feeling like they're the only ones that, you know, because it can be very isolating living in Sarasota, Florida, if you, you know, are not not on the right, on, you know, if you're not a Republican and you're in Sarasota, it can be isolating. But, you know, the more that people are showing up, and the more that people are speaking out, we see that we are actually in the majority, and that there are so many more people that agree with us than do not.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more, because I know, you know, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, I never hesitated to put the bumper sticker on my car, because every time I saw somebody else with, like, you know, a Harris bumper sticker, or back in the day, you know, an Obama sticker, or, you know, it made me feel good. It made me feel like, you know, I wasn't alone. I wasn't the only one, because I live in Manatee County, which Sarasota's red.
just
drive a little further north. You know, we'll get the crazy guys driving around, and well, not crazy guys, they're expressing their opinion, driving around in their pickup trucks festooned with Trump flags.
Yeah.
I know one of the ways you organize these things is you send out, email blasts to, you know, people who are on your list. You know, are you you getting good response? I mean, does it look like there's going to be some people there?
Oh, yeah. We're having people, more and more people RSVP every day. My email inbox is blowing up because I am, you know, I am the contact for it. So, yes, we are having, we'll have, you know, thousands of people there for sure.
Awesome. That's great. You know, because also, too, you know, as we've seen, you know, a day doesn't go by, once again, not just crazy stuff, but authoritarian moves towards basically taking over the democracy, you know, not the least of which is this business about, you know, redistricting, you know, mid-decade redistricting in Texas, and now, of course, you know, Florida, not to be outdone, yeah, is claiming, yeah, they want to try to do that, too, which is, yeah, just, you know, blatant manipulation of the electorate.
It's stealing the elections. Let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
It's cheating democracy.
Well, you know, as any of us who, you know, follow the news, I guess, and, you know, read a little bit, you know, understand that, you know, right now, you know, because the Republicans control, you know, the House and the Senate and the presidency, and that the Republicans in Congress are just basically rubber stamping everything the executive does, you know, it does, for all intents and purposes, make him, you know, a dictator. So, you know, mm-hmm, the only chance for democracy right now, I believe, is the 2026 elections, you know, to get some oversight, you know, and some control, you know. And,
yeah,
and if they're going to rig that election and make that impossible, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I think it's also important to just note that at the state level, we have a lot of power, too, and that, like, you know, as the Trump administration is deregulating things, more and more power is being kicked back to the states. And so it's really important that we organize not just around the big federal elections, but also, you know, the midterms in Florida. We have, you know, the governor is up. We have, you know, state house and state senate and a lot of different important elections that we have to participate in as well. School board elections are also really important. We are seeing, you know, in Sarasota County, all kinds of scary stuff coming through as a response to the defunding that we're seeing, the funding of public education that we're seeing in Tallahassee. And so in Sarasota, we are organizing a really strong coalition of public support, of public education advocates to defend our public schools here in Sarasota. And so we need everybody to get involved. We need people to just, you know, to stop complaining and to jump into the fight with us and to start showing up at school board meetings and start showing up at strategy sessions and to start, you know, taking our power back.
Yeah.
And, like, if you saw what happened in Iowa, it was a working mother and community organizer who just flipped the Iowa State Senate seat and, you know, actually ended they had had a supermajority in Iowa as well. And so now that is no longer the case because of this state Senate seat that was just won. And so if they can do that in Iowa, we can certainly do that in Sarasota.
Yeah, and that is something interesting in Iowa. As a matter of fact, I just read it this morning, a story that I didn't realize. You know, Iowa, of course, is well known for its agricultural economy, you mm-hmm. know, and apparently farmers, you know, guess what farmers are really relying on these days for, you know, a big bunch of their income? Wind turbines that they put on their mm-hmm. land in addition
that
to growing crops. And that
yeah.
apparently like 60% of the electricity for Iowa comes from, like, wind farms. Now, who wants to, you know, and they're all freaking out now because any of the new projects that were, you know, going to be funded by Joe Biden's bills and that group, you know, they've got till 2027 to basically get them done, and they have to get them started before the end of this year, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of those aren't going to happen, and a lot of the other ones aren't going to happen, so, you know. These are all reasons. This is, like, I'm just pointing this out. It's like, this is a very red state. You know, and you made a great point that this may be one of the reasons why they're starting to flip. And you know, here in Sarasota, I mean, I know your day job is with Social Equity Through Education, the Alliance how's that work going? You know, I mean, are young people starting to get involved?
Oh yeah, yeah. There are so many young people that are getting involved. We had a rally here yesterday in response to the public art that is being torn up just yesterday, and there were lots of young people. You know, young people, young moms with kids. There were, you know, younger like student age people. It was a really great display of people. You know, we're a multi-generational space here, and so we are seeing, you know, just such a diverse coalition of people that keep showing up and keep getting involved. And so it's really inspiring in the face of everything that we are dealing with. There's nowhere else I would rather be working, because it is really inspiring to be here and to see all of these incredible young people that show up and speak up and continue to get involved and continue to grow the movement.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt for a second for people who are just tuning in. This is WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WLPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Julie Forrester, president of the Democratic Women's Club of Sarasota, you know, who also works for C, Society Equity Through Education Alliance, founded by Xander
Social. Woods. Yeah. Social equity.
So, you're not special, that's right. Social equity. I would claim that I can't read my own writing, but it's tight. I'll tell you what, the effect, you know, that you're seeing some interest and enthusiasm from young people, you know, is incredibly positive to me, because I found it really disappointing, you know, and this is actually from talking to my son, who's like in his early 30s, you know, from what he hears, and just my own view is how, you know, Democrats had missed the message to these young men. These young men just, they voted for Trump because they thought he was a tough guy, and they thought Democrats only cared about, you know, gender issues, you know, which is nonsense, of course.
Hopefully
you're starting to see some people that are, you know, or young people, you know, who are going to be an important, I guess, block in future elections. Obviously, they always are. Realizing that, you know, we need to preserve the democracy, you know, for any of them to have a chance, any of all of us to have a chance. I mean, mm-hmm.
That's the brilliance behind the school board organizing that we do at C Alliance, you know, because it's really focused on school boards as a way to engage with young people. You know, young people are the experts in school boards. It's also they have the biggest impact, the biggest ability to impact school board policy and elections, and so it just makes sense. And when they see that they can have an impact, and when they show up and they, you know, start speaking at school board meetings and they get involved, it's really inspiring to watch it happen, right? To watch young people get activated. And once there is also a statistic that says that once, you know, if a student shows up, or anybody, actually doesn't matter what age you are, if you show up at a school board meeting, you are much more likely to, I think like four times more likely to vote for the rest of your life. And so, you know, just by showing up at school board meetings and showing them, like, you know, that they do have the power to impact school board policy, and because they are the experts and because they are the ones that are most impacted by school board policy, it just makes sense as a way to activate them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's a great plan, and you know, nobody is a better, I guess, example of how that can start a student on the road to political activism than, you know, the founder of your group, Xander Moritz.
Yes.
You know, who's been pretty brilliant, you know, a young voice for, you know, these sort of progressive policies. Are you excited about Monday? I mean, is that going to be a big event?
Yeah, very excited. It will, you know, we're, like I said, we're expecting thousands of people. It will be a great event, and we need everybody that, you know, is sitting at home, that is, you know, tired of watching the craziness come out of D.C. And even like people that are upset about everything that's happening, you know, at a statewide level as well. We're just, you know, like I mentioned, we are seeing art being tore up off the streets, and like it is just, you know, it's all, these are all, you know, fascist power plays. And so anybody that is tired of sitting at home and seeing what's happening should show up on Monday at one of the protests. There, like I mentioned, they are throughout the area. There will be multiple, and you could even show up in the morning at one and then come in the evening to Bayfront. That was another reason that we thought the evening on Monday was a good time, because there were other ones happening in the morning, nothing else happening in the evening. So we need everybody to just really show up and to show that this movement is continuing to grow, and that, you know, because we are more powerful together, and we have to show that that we are stronger than the billionaires trying to divide us.
Yeah, I guess, and that goes back to like the real fact that, you know, the workers do totally outnumber the billionaires, and until they're able to, you know, minimize that, you know, one person, one vote, and the value of that in a democracy, you know, if we can get everybody to show up, we're going to win, and I think that, as you pointed out, is like the most encouraging and greatest thing about these events. Is that they show everybody, you know, I find them very encouraging, because, you know, those are all voters. Those are all people that will hopefully, you know, turn the tide. Now, of course, you know, here in Florida, you know, it's already been, you know, redistricted to heck, you know, thanks to Governor Ron DeSantis, you know, and if they try to pull another fast one, you know, before 2026, I don't know, you know. But that is, you know, trying to get involved to preserve the democracy, because I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, one thing that I am really excited about is just that, you know, as people show up, that's a launching point. That's an activator. And then from there, you know, they get involved, they organize, they continue to speak out, they continue to show up at school board meetings and take collective action in our community. And so I think that is really one of the most exciting things about all of these events, is just like seeing all these people get activated. Every protest I'm at, I meet somebody who it's their first protest, and then they come to more, and then they're on our list, and then they continue to get involved, and the movement continues to grow. And so it's always a really inspiring time.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, you know, on that note, you know, I really want to thank you, Julie Forrester, for making time for me today. You know, and I hope to see you, you know, on Monday. And so please tell folks a little bit more about, you know, what they need to know, you know, and about this upcoming protest, you know, and what they need to know about learning more about C and the Democratic Women's Club.
Yes. So if you want to come on Monday, we would love to see you. Please show up at Bayfront Park, the Bayfront Park area, at 5:30 p.m. We will have speakers at J.D. Hamill Park, which is just on the east side of 41, and then from there we are just going to be waving signs and, you know, standing in solidarity. So we hope to see everybody there. Bring water. We'll have some water and electrolytes and all of that, but it's always just good to come prepared. Bring your signs. You know, the theme is workers over billionaires, so anything that is in support of workers' rights, you know, fighting the billionaire takeover of our democracy, you know, supporting public schools, any of that kind of stuff is great. And if you want to learn more about the C Alliance, it's www.seeourpower.org. And the Democratic Women's Club, you can find us, it's the Democratic Women's Club of Sarasota County. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. And I'm not sure off the top of our head.
You just Google Democratic Women's Club.
Oh, it's TWC for Sarasota.org. TWC number 4 Sarasota.org.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, once again, I really want to thank you, Julie Forrester, and, you know, great work, and I know we'll be speaking again at some point. You know, thanks again. You have a great day.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Bye now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
A man set fire to a U.S. flag across the street from the White House this week to protest President Donald Trump's anti-flag burning executive order. The man was arrested in Lafayette Square, but not on grounds of violating the order or of burning the flag. Instead, he was charged with violating a law against setting fires at federal parks. Video posted on social media shows the man in the park saying that he would ignite the flag to protest Trump's order issued earlier Monday. The man called the order illegal. The Supreme Court has ruled that burning the flag is a mode of symbolic speech protected under the First Amendment. Trump's order appeared to acknowledge the court's decision, but to aim at instances of flag burning where he indicated that the court's ruling might not apply, such as when they result in incitement to imminent lawless action. In the video, the man who burned the flag described himself as a retired Army combat veteran. "I fought for every one of you, for every one of your rights," he told perhaps two dozen people gathered near him in the park. The man said no president had the right to make an order infringing the First Amendment. "We burned this flag in protest," he said. After the man ignited the flag, the video showed a law enforcement officer quelling the blaze with a fire extinguisher. In the video, the man was taken into custody by officers who appeared to be from the U.S. Secret Service. The Secret Service said it detained an individual in Lafayette Park for igniting an object. It said the person detained was then turned over to U.S. Park Police, which has jurisdiction in the park. The park police said that it made an arrest in connection with a fire that was prohibited under a section of Code of Federal Regulations that deals with fires in, on, or at parks, forests, or federal property. Neither agency reported specifically that the fire involved a flag, and they did not identify the man by name. What has been described as an unsparing memoir by one of Jeffrey Epstein's most outspoken accusers is set for release this autumn. The book entitled Nobody's Girl, A Memoir of Surviving Abuse and Fighting for Justice, is a posthumous account of abuse and tragedy by Virginia Guffrey that will be published on October 21st by publishing house Alfred A. Knopf. Guffrey, who died by suicide in April of this year at the age of 41, had been working on Nobody's Girl with author-journalist Amy Wallace and had completed the manuscript for the 400-page book, according to Knopf. The publisher's statement includes an email from Guffrey to Wallace a few weeks before her death, stating that it was her heartfelt wish for the memoir to be released, regardless of her circumstances. "In the event of my passing, I would like to ensure that Nobody's Girl is still released. I believe it has the potential to impact many lives and foster necessary discussions about these grave injustices," she wrote to Wallace. Guffrey went on to describe the book as crucial, saying her story aims to shed light on the systemic failures that allowed the trafficking of vulnerable individuals across borders. And she went on to say it is imperative that the truth is understood and that the issues surrounding this topic are addressed, both for the sake of justice and awareness. She says she was caught up in Epstein's sex trafficking ring and exploited by Britain's Prince Andrew and other influential men. Prince Andrew has always denied Guffrey's allegations, and in 2022, Guffrey and Andrew reached an out-of-court settlement after she had sued him for sexual assault. Epstein was found dead in a New York jail cell in 2019 in what investigators described as a suicide, while his former girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, was convicted in late 2021 on sex trafficking and other charges. In July of this year, President Donald Trump told reporters that Epstein had stolen Guffrey from Mar-a-Lago, his private club in Florida, where she once worked. Virginia had alleged that Maxwell hired her as a masseuse for Epstein, Maxwell has denied Jeffrey's allegation. According to the publishers of Nobody's Girl, it contains intimate, disturbing, and heartbreaking new details about her time with Epstein, Maxwell, and her many well-known friends, including Prince Andrew, about whom she speaks publicly for the first time since her out-of-court settlement in 2022. Knopf publisher and editor-in-chief Jordan Pavlin has described the book as raw and shocking.